There it is.
Okay, let's start the meeting. We're very lucky today to have Elsheva Goldberg, who was originally scheduled for 2 weeks ago, but got sick, and we've got it together today. And she's going to be talking to us about what's going on in Masafta Yatta, and there's a little map there. Before we start, let me just remind people that in 2 weeks, we have Mitchell Plitnik, who will be talking about what the Biden administration isn't doing about Palestinian rights. And 2 weeks later, we're going to have Uri Talil, who's sitting on the call right now, explaining why Israel peace is unattainable and what an American peacenik should do now. The Masafta Yatta is the Supreme Court allowed an expulsion to go on. And it's interesting when you look at this expulsion versus other times that the Supreme Court allowed expulsions to go on, which some have happened and some haven't happened. And the details and the intricacies and the politics will be described by a speaker. She works now for the New Israel Fund and is the director of media and policy. And she writes for Jewish Currents, where I saw her write about this, plus other things. She speaks Hebrew and Arabic. She used to work for Tipsni Livni when she was head of the opposition. She has degrees from Columbia and from the University of Pennsylvania. She now lives in New York. In the past, she's lived and worked in Israel, Egypt, and Morocco. So I'm going to turn the floor over to her now, and she can expand on her introduction as she sees fit.
Everyone needs to mute.
And Dick, I'm making Dick a co-host so he can mute people.
Hi, everyone. It's very nice to see you all today. Thank you for joining us at this slightly earlier hour. I am in an earlier stage of life and have two young children, twins, and I'm also pregnant, which is why you'll see me bouncing a little bit on this ball. I feel like I can share these things with you because we're in this very small, but I'm sure lovely group that you have. So thank you for having me. Again, you know, as Jeff introduced me, my name is Elsheva Goldberg. Most people call me Chev, which is much easier. And I am the New Israel Fund's Director of Media and Policy. Just one word about the New Israel Fund, which is that the New Israel Fund protects and advances democracy and equality in Israel. That's its mission. And over the last 40 plus years of its existence, NAF has given out millions of dollars to progressive causes in Israel, including but not limited to anti-occupation organizations, some of which I'll reference today. So I'm just going to start by giving you a bit of background
Let me interrupt that you can give money tax deductible through NIF to any of these organizations also. Excuse me, go on.
No, thank you, Jeff. I appreciate that. That's a plug I wouldn't have made myself. That's true. The New Israel Fund allows for donations to be given to many of the organizations that I'll reference. And you can always, you know, just give money to the New Israel Fund, where we also give direct grants ourselves. So I'm going to start by telling you a little bit about myself and my relationship to this region, so you know where I'm coming from. I will never forget the first time that I went to a Palestinian village in Area C of the West Bank. It was back in 2006. I was 18 years old, if you can believe that. And the village I went to was situated just minutes from the Israeli religious seminary that I was attending in a settlement. And for me, the shock was dramatic. I couldn't believe the disparity, the profound unequal distribution of resources that I saw. And since that time, since 2006, I've visited, planted with, harvested with, and become friends with many of the Palestinians living in villages like the ones we're talking about in Masafta Yatta. And I think that my story is not unique. In fact, I think that many people visit the West Bank for the first time with organizations like Breaking the Silence or Encounter, which is a more American organization, and have experiences that unsettle them for years afterwards. And it works to activate these people like me towards work, you know, towards a different future. So seeing something as painful as what I'm about to talk about today really motivates people to act. And I do hope that part of what you get out of this conversation is that there are things to do. So I also, I lived in Israel that year, and then I moved back for 6 years between 2012 and 2018. And I've never stopped being impressed by the people who live in this area. You're catching me actually right now, despite being 34 weeks pregnant. I was just in the region 2.5 weeks ago, and that's why I got sick, because I took a long flight back and I got very ill. But I was there for 5 days, and 3 of those days I spent in this region, largely to record some of the residents for a podcast that the New Israel Fund, in conjunction with another organization, is working on. It's called Groundwork. I'm happy to send you links to see that. There are only 3 episodes out right now, but more to come, one of which will be about Musafer Yatta. So that's about me. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you what I'm going to tell you, and then we're going to talk about the things that I'm going to tell you. So here's what I'm going to do. First, I'm going to give you some background on the area. Just to refresh everyone's memory, I'm going to show you a map of the places a little bit more defined than the one that's that Jeff showed us. And I'm going to give you the basic history of the people who live there. And then I'm going to zoom in a little bit. And I'm going to talk specifically about the court case that happened in March, and the sort of thing that made the news in this area, and why I wrote about it recently. And then I'm going to zoom in even further and talk about the costs that this court case and just simply living in Musafer Yatta have on the people who live there, and why the situation is not sustainable. And I'm going to close with what's being done about the situation. And I'm going to include but not limit my what's being done section to a conversation about the New Israel Fund's grantees and what they're doing. And then, of course, there's question and answer. And I'm going to try and, if I'm speaking too fast, let me know. But I'm going to try and get through a lot of material in a short amount of time. Questions until now? Wonderful. So, background. Area C of the West Bank, just to remind us all, makes up 60% of the land of the West Bank. It's where all of the settlements are located. Areas A and B and C are all Oslo-era designations. They started in the 90s. A is under the ostensible control of the Palestinian Authority, B is shared, and C is completely controlled by Israel. So, because C is where all of the settlements are located, it is also the place where the Israeli army would prefer the Palestinians not be located, when there are, in fact, something like 100,000 Palestinians that live in Area C, despite the desires of the Israeli army. These are people who often don't have much to begin with. And this is the area, to my mind, where the occupations and injustices really shine the brightest. And Musafer Yatta, in some ways, is representative of Area C. And all, you know, there's, again, Area C is vast. It's 60% of the West Bank. And there are swaths of Area C that are in the Jordan Valley that are very similar to the situation in Musafer Yatta. And it's also not representative because it is a place of heightened activism. It's a place where a lot of internationals go. It's a place where a lot of American Jews have spent a lot of time and done a lot of activism. And it's also a place where the Palestinians speak more English than often you find in Area C. So I'm gonna now share a screen, and I'm gonna show you a map. Hang on, I forget how to share this screen. Second.
You click on the green square in the bottom.
There we go. Thank you. Yeah, yeah. Wonderful. Okay, here we go. So this is the Musafer Yatta region, this whole area. It's called Musafer Yatta. Hang on, let me see if I can zoom in. Can you see? How's that?
Great.
This is the region. It's called Musafer Yatta because it's close to the city of Yatta. You can see on the left-hand side of the screen, there's this big brown area. That's the city of Yatta. It's the southernmost city in the West Bank. And it is brown because it's under Palestinian control. It's Area A. These other areas that you're seeing are Area C, which are not under Palestinian control. You can also see the extent to which, I'm zooming in just a little bit for everybody, the extent to which you have Israeli settlements that pepper the map between these Palestinian towns. So anything that has a KH in front of it, that's Khirbet. That means that it's a place where people live in caves. It's a place where people have lived for generations, and it's usually a Palestinian town. But you also can see places called Ma'on and Mitzpe Ya'ir. And some of these places are established settlements, and some of these places are fully illegal outposts, according to international law, but also according to Israeli law, and have been there since the early 2000s. One more map. This is where the firing zone is. So there are 14 villages in the area that is essentially a remote suburb of Yatta, right? In this whole area, everybody goes and gets services from Yatta. Everybody goes and, a lot of people have family that live in Yatta. And there are 14 villages that are in this area that is called Musafir Yatta. But actually the ones that we're talking about specifically today are really only 8 villages that the court decided are the ones that it's going to allow to be evicted. So I want to, it's a kind of a difficult, weird shape for us to think about, but it is like, and it is, you know, there are Palestinian villages like Atwane, which you see right north of Arakiz and right next to Ma'on, which is in Musafir Yatta, but not in the firing zone, right? So like, it's a complicated dynamic internally also, because these people, some of whom are, they've all lived there for many years and are all sort of very close because they live in this remote area. Some of them are much more threatened than others, but the ones that aren't feel like, well, it's us next. Like if this actually succeeds, it's us next. And I've heard them say that to me. So with that, I will stop sharing my screen for now. And I will say that the other thing about Musafir Yatta, let me go into the history very quickly, very briefly. Some people who live in this area, some of these people who live in the 14 villages, used to live there before 48. They lived in caves, they lived as Bedouin, they would, which means that they would migrate seasonally, but they would live in the caves. This was their permanent dwelling. And it was very difficult in the case for the defense lawyers to prove that they lived there in the 60s and 70s, say, because when you look at aerial photos, all you can see is caves. You don't see structures. You don't see that people lived there from photos that you see from the 60s and 70s. You just see caves. now, there are other villages that actually became refugees in 1948, many of them from the Arad area, which is just south of the West Bank, but sits in Israel proper. And it's something like 35 kilometers away. But when 48 hit, the Bedouin who lived there were like, okay, we're gonna go, we think this might be temporary. We're gonna leave where we permanently live. And we're gonna go to our agricultural and grazing grounds that we usually live in the summer, where there's a little bit more water and a little bit more, vegetation. And we're gonna live there for the interim. Now that obviously didn't pan out and they stayed there. So these are people who were refugees in 48 who are now potentially facing another imminent expulsion, what many of them would call another Nakba now in 2022. So that's pre-48, 48, and then obviously in 67, the Israeli military occupies this territory. Not a ton changes immediately in 67 for these people. They're in a very remote area. They're still living their Bedouin lives. They're still living in the same kind of way with dry farming and shepherding, sort of as their basic income and getting their services from Yatta. But around 1980, 1981, the army declares much of the land that they are grazing on as state land. And what that winds up being is that, the process, which is familiar, I'm sure, to a lot of us, that state land is transferred to organizations that then transfer it to settlers. And now there is, next to many of these places, full-blown settlements that sit on the land that they used to graze on. It meant that as Bedouin, they could not continue their lifestyle grazing their flocks. And many of them turned to manual labor in settlements or in Israel. And so many of the settlements were established in the 1980s, and the outposts were only established a little bit later, and I'll get to that in a second. In 1999, the army declared that the residents were illegally, I forgot one big important thing that also happened in 1981, which is that the firing zone was declared by the army, which meant that these people were technically living illegally in a military firing zone. It was not enforced until 1999 when the army declared that these 700 residents of certain villages were illegally living in a firing zone, and they loaded them into trucks and forcibly transferred them out of the area. And I spoke with people who remember this mostly as children, And they have just quite a bit of trauma around it. But that was the first time that these people, there was an attempt to move them physically out of this place. Basically immediately, that same year, the Association for Civil Rights in Israel, which is the New Israel Fund's flagship grantee, asked the court for an injunction, basically a stay of execution on this ruling. Don't move these people out, let them stay until we figure out if they're actually permanent residents, if they're allowed to be where they're allowed to be by international and by Israeli law. And it worked. So for the last 22 years, this area has had an injunction on it where there have been no live fire military exercises, but instead it has been sort of in legal limbo where the people have been waiting for an answer from the court. There's another turning point here, which is in 2002, when many of the outposts began to be built. And what it meant is that people's commute, people trying to get from these remote villages into the city of Yatta, where all of their resources are, where all of their medical services are, where all of their shopping is, where all of their family is, were no longer allowed to use particular roads that the settlers were now using, and instead had to go around on these very windy, very bumpy, and I can attest, very uncomfortable roads, because I was just on them. For the last 20 years, they've had to do this. And that was in 2002, and some very violent settlers live in these outposts and have been attacking these and making the lives of these villagers very, very difficult. So let's skip from 2002 to 2022. And I'll say that, you know, again, this was 22 years of litigation. And in March of this year, the court ruled against the residents, against their plea that they could stay in this place the army had declared a firing zone, and said, no, actually, the army has full legal sanction to evict in whatever way the people who live in this firing zone. It basically said the army can have this firing zone, even though the army has many other firing zones. And that ruling was handed down by a panel of three judges, which is a relatively small panel. And the implication was that now live fire drills can start. After 22 years of not having them, we can have them again. The attorneys for ACRI were quick to point out that this clearly contravenes international law, specifically Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which I can read to you, but I can also just pop it in the chat because I am not a scholar of international law, but I do believe that if you read it, you will understand what the lawyers were talking about. And the people who live in these eight villages is somewhere around 1,000, probably closer to 2,000, but the numbers are very difficult to ascertain. And these are the people, many of whom are minors, who can be evicted from their homes. Activists, however, predict that this eviction will not look like the eviction in 1999. The eviction in 1999 was a forcible transfer that was clear as day. It was putting people on trucks and moving them out. This will look a lot more gradual and a lot less aggressive. It will be slow confiscations, evictions, road blockages, making life very difficult for the people who live there so that they leave. That is if you look at basically the whole picture, that is what it looks like. So now I'm going to zoom in one more time and talk about the personal cost to the people living there. Now, I think this group doesn't need me to tell them how bad things can be for Palestinians in life under occupation, but I am going to tell you just a little bit because it is extremely troubling. So before the firing zone was allowed to go forward, these villages lack basic services. We're talking about water, which they pay for at a high cost and can only get pumped in a handful of hours a week. They are not connected to Israel's electric grid, whereas the settlements that surround them are connected. And in fact, not only are the settlements connected to the electric grid, but also electric grid, I keep saying grill, the electric grid, but also the chicken farms and other sort of factory spaces, the cattle farm are connected to the electric grid. So over the heads of some of these villagers, you can see electric wires that go from the settlement to the farm. And yet the people who live there do not have electricity. Instead, it's not that they do not have electricity. That is incorrect. They have electricity that is provided by limited, but very important solar panels that sit on their shanties and shacks. These people are not allowed to pave their roads. everything that they build, in some cases, not everything, it really depends on the space, but many things that they build are considered illegal and therefore can obtain a demolition order and be destroyed. So they live in kind of a constant state of limbo. I mean, it's not just legal limbo that they've been living in for 22 years. It's, will we have water? Will we have enough electricity? And they suffer quite a bit in, for example, the winter, when the solar panels don't get enough sunlight to power the things that they need. Obviously, everything has sort of become more challenging since the court ruling. I was actually in one of these villages adjacent to the firing zone while the live fire drills were going on. And I heard that day, ACRI asked for another injunction because a bullet from the firing zone, from the live fire drill had whizzed by the ear of, you know, somebody sitting in their cave and had hit the wall. And ACRI basically said, this is unsafe. There are people living here. You cannot continue to do this. And the court said, okay, you know, well, we meant to have our these military exercises for the whole month. We're going to stop now and we'll see what happens going forward. But they have no intention of undeclaring it a firing zone. So I have every expectation that this will continue. Last week alone, B'Tselem, which is an Israeli human rights organization that documents things like this, noted that basically the demolitions have increased significantly. The civil administration, which is the arm of the army that executes the demolition orders mostly and confiscates various things, that they demolished a home, two livestock pens, a rest tent, and confiscated three water tanks just from one village. It's gotten pretty bad. Now, this is also a place where there's a lot of settler violence and there's a lot of army violence. So as I mentioned, this is a community of shepherds or that of used to be shepherds. These are people who you need a lot of space to graze their flocks. And if they don't have it, what they have to do is buy expensive hay for their flocks. When I was talking to people, I talked to somebody who told me that his cousin had to sell half of his flock in order to feed the rest of his flock. But 2 years ago, for example, a family that had bought 82 bales of hay, which was supposed to last the entire year, settlers came and at, you know, 9:30, 10 p.m., lit them all on fire. And that was the end of his supply for the year, which makes, again, the whole project here, especially from settler perspective, is to make life impossible to live, which also means sort of on the flip side, right? If there's a ripple of violence there, the ripple of response is that what activists do is to make life possible, is to make existence possible. There's a phrase that we use in the activist world that existence is resistance. And that's really what it's about here in places like Muzaffar Yatta. So I could go into more versions of settler violence, but you don't need me to. I will say that there is an element here in which the army often works hand in glove with the settlers, that in that the army often will stand and protect the settlers and allow attacks to happen without intervening, even as it is their job to protect the people who live there. And it's also a kind of ring around the settlements. So like, as if Palestinians get close to settlements, they can face the army and they can be arrested. Last year, five Palestinian kids somewhere in the range of, you know, the ages of 9 to 13 were arrested because they were picking a seasonal plant near a settlement. So yes, there's a litany of outrageous acts, and I can show you, I will share this, but I will not go into it because it is too much for me to do in this session, both psychologically and also in terms of our time. So I just want to mention one more thing that makes life hard for these people, and it has to do with what I mentioned before, which is that there is something that gives them hope, which is feeling like they have that the international community, Jewish activists in particular, but beyond, basically in general, the international community has their back. And one of the most important things that has been done for them and has been done with them in the last number of years is solidarity activism of various kinds. There are people who live there, Israelis and American Jews who live on the ground in this area, standing with them, standing in front of them when it comes to settlers and army violence. And to my mind, one of the most important and challenging things that the army has done since the court ruling is that it has stopped activists from accessing the area. For example, the Friday after the court decision, activists organized 10 buses to arrive to protest and stand in solidarity with the Palestinian residents of Safra Yatta. But the IDF stopped them on their way, and they were forced to carry out their protest on the side of the highway instead of actually in the villages of Safra Yatta. Last week, Thursday, July 28th, soldiers erected a flying checkpoint between two different villages inside of Safra Yatta, and they confiscated, which they've been doing with some frequency, vehicles. One of the vehicles was owned and operated by the Palestinian-Israeli nonprofit Comet ME. Comet ME is the organization that provides and maintains the solar panels that these Palestinians have, which is their only access to electricity. So this is just a couple of examples of sort of how this is working and why this is a more challenging situation than many other places, even in Area C. So I'm going to now play you a 2-minute clip of audio that I took of my friend Ode Hafalin speaking about his life in Safra Yatta. Let me know if you can't hear it, but I hope actually that it will be as clear as I am right now. So I'm gonna play this, just one more.
So these people, they lived the Nakba in 1948. They are living this, eviction, in 1999. And we are really scared that they will live the third Nakba, really soon. Because after this decision, everything is really scary. I mean, 8 villages. But what if the occupation succeeded to evict these 8 villages? What will happen? For me, this is the most scary thing. Okay, they evicted these 8 villages. What's next? What they will do next? They will continue to evict more Palestinian villages. The villages which they have a private land, like Umar Khif. Here, we have our lands, ours, we have papers in it. But the issue is if they succeeded to evict and push these villages out of their places, they will not, stop there. They will continue.
That's Ode Hafalin talking about his fear based on this court case that, it's 8 villages today. What is it tomorrow? And I think that is, broadly speaking, the sentiment that I heard when I went to speak with residents of this area. I'm going to now talk about who's doing what, but before I do, I wanna ask if there are questions. I see we have some time, so I don't wanna jump into the last section without answering anything that you may wanna ask. Tony, go ahead.
I noticed from the history that you gave me that the firing zone was declared in 1881, long before the Oslo Accords broke it into areas A, B, and C. So this is something that was never acknowledged by the Oslo negotiations.
That's a good question. 18% of Area C has been at some point declared a firing zone. And many of those firing zones were declared in the 80s. And I actually don't know where in the Oslo Accords, if at all, they are addressed. Yeah. Part of the logic of a firing zone, at least for the army, is that it cannot theoretically, in this case it does, contravene international law. Because if the army declares a place absolutely critical for its operation, then there are provisions in international law where that can work. But because there's such vast swaths of the West Bank that are declared firing zones, the swaths here, this is a large swath, but there are much larger in places like the Jordan Valley. Because it's so vast, it's very difficult to believe that in fact the army really does need these for its purposes and can't make do with other tracts of land.
Yeah, especially with the desert right outside of the occupied territories. I mean, If you need firing zones to practice, why not put it out there where there's nobody living?
Right. And this was one of the lines of argument that the Association for Civil Rights in Israel used when they were defending the residents of the area in court.
So it's something to look to research.
Yeah, something to look into. I don't know the answer about the Oslo courts.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I noticed that on your map that the firing zone goes across one of these outposts. I think it was called Merin. I guess that'll just be ignored.
Yeah, it cuts kind of sideways. It's not, they call it the inactive part of the firing zone. But yeah, there are settlements that are adjacent to, if not, near the firing zone. Presumably, I mean, part of what is about the geography that you don't see on the map is that settlements are built on the hill. They're built on the top, right? And Palestinian villages are often built into the hill for the purposes of grazing, for the purposes of growing things, for the purposes of, you know, having caves to live in. And so part of it is also geographical. I mean, I don't know what the army's real, you know, vision is here, but I'm sure that has something to do with it. Can I call on other folks? Eric, and then Joseph, and then David?
Yeah, just a very quick question. From the map and from your description, I gather that these villages, or if you can call them villages, these tiny places where people live, are not very far from Yatta. But actually in miles or of course access is not the same thing as miles, but what the actual distances are we talking about? 5 kilometers, less than that?
Yeah, we're talking, I mean, depends on the village, right? Because if you look at this map here, let's look at it really quickly. Let me share my screen one more time. Can you see?
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, from Atwane, right? Can you see Atwane? Can you see me highlighting it or no?
Yes, yes.
Okay, from Atwane to get to Yatta, if you didn't have this settlement of Ma'on here and its outpost, which you actually can't see, which is about here, you could travel to Yatta in 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the distance kilometers wise, we could measure it, but that's what they say, 20 minutes. With the settlement, they've closed a major road that would give them access to Yatta. And instead it takes them an hour and a half to get to Yatta. So the story that I was talking to somebody in Tuba, which is actually, you can't even see here, it's too small, but it's right next to Tuane. And in order to get from Tuane to Tuba, you also have to go around this crazy bumpy road because of the settlement of Ma'on. And there are kids who, still take the original road to get to school in Tuane from Tuba. So you're imagining little kids, 6, 7, 8, 9, who need to walk on the settler road to get from their village of Tuba to the school in Tuane, which is 2 or 3 kilometers. And in order to do that, they need an army escort every single day to go to and from their school. Everybody else doesn't take that road anymore. Everybody else does the crazy 10 kilometer, like around, you know, goes all the way around to get to the other side of the settlement and to get to Yatta. So access is a really big issue and it is highly impacted by the locations of these settlements. And you know, it is a bit of a chicken and egg when it comes to settlements, right? Like where the settlements placed, the settlements are often placed where they're placed on purpose in order to drive out Palestinians. But also once Palestinians are there, you know, the army helps move things along by not letting them get anywhere near there unless they have a court order, for example, like they have in the case of the kids from Tuba to Tuane. Who did I call on next?
It's me, Joseph.
Go ahead, Joseph.
You mentioned going to the Israeli Supreme Court. Area C hasn't been annexed by Israel. So what is the jurisdiction that the Israeli Supreme Court has over Area C And why would you go to the Israeli Supreme Court to decide about that area? Isn't that legitimizing the Israeli so-called democracy and the Israeli Supreme Court over area that it by itself does not recognize as the state of Israel?
That's an incredibly complex question. And it is a debate. I'll just start with the second half of your question, which is, isn't it legitimizing? There's a debate inside of the Israeli legal human rights community about whether or not it makes sense to go to the Supreme Court to take these cases that aren't going to get the justice that they deserve in the Israeli Supreme Court. And many human rights lawyers feel that there is, because there is no other option, and the Palestinians are asking for help, that this is the only thing to do. And there, you know, there's a book that Michael Sfard, who is a preeminent human rights lawyer, wrote called "The Wall and the Gate." The Wall and the Gate, which I highly recommend, and it basically delves into this question that has been alive in Israel since the 80s, 90s, for sure. I mean, it's an incredibly difficult question for human rights lawyers to answer. But in terms of your first question, the jurisdiction is tricky also. I'm gonna try and explain this, but I do a little bit of explaining in a piece that I wrote also for Jewish Currents, which I can send you a little bit later. But if I remember correctly, part of the reason, so in Israeli civil law, right, there's an appellate court system. You take your case to whatever court, and the Supreme Court is the highest court of appeals. In some ways, like the United States, right? The Supreme Court is the highest court in the land. Once you get past the district court and the magistrate court, you go to the Supreme Court. When it came to British mandate law, there was a bit of a holdover, because any subject of an occupation is allowed to go to the highest court in the land. So the Supreme Court is called the Supreme Court in Israel, and it's actually called the High Court of Justice. This is a technical way of distinguishing these things. They're the same justices, but it is the High Court of Justice for Palestinians. And any Palestinian who claims that they were wronged by the state, right? In this case, obviously, we're talking about the army, which is an arm of the state. But any Palestinian who claims that they were wronged by the state can go directly to the highest court in the land. And this is how it was under the British mandate, and this is how it continued to be applied once the occupation was established in 1967. That's the most basic version that I can give you here, but it's a very complicated question of jurisdiction, and the way that the court gives itself jurisdiction over this is also very complicated. So it's an excellent question, Joseph, but I don't think that I don't think I have the time or even like the memory to remember exactly how that works. Is that fair?
Yeah. What's the name of the book?
I think it's called The Wall and the Gate.
And what's the name of the author?
Michael Sfard.
Michael?
Michael.
S-F-A-R-D, Joe.
I'm sorry?
S-F-A-R-D. Sfard.
Okay.
Is the book in Hebrew and English or just English?
I don't know if it's in Hebrew. I read it in English. I imagine it is. Yes, David.
Hi, thanks. That was a very good brief explanation of the High Court of Justice. And it's only relatively recently that the Israeli human rights community has starting with B'Tselem, I think, is said we're not going to go there anymore because it's a lost cause and it is affording this bit of legitimacy. The question I had, just to get straight some of the historical things, I think I heard you say that some of the people in Masafer Yatta were refugees in 48 from what became Israel. And at the same, I've heard some of them say that their families have lived there for hundreds of years. So those could obviously both be true. It could be that some are refugees and some lived there previously. I just wanted to get to straighten that out so I know the facts.
Sure, yeah, that's absolutely right. There are families that have lived there for many, many, many generations in caves and have a unique lifestyle of cave dwelling, that it was, you know, these were their permanent residence for many, many, many years. It's, again, hard to prove that. And that was what I was talking about with the aerial photos, right? From you know, before, certainly before the firing zone. But there are also families in the, you know, Aude, who you heard, he is from a village that came from Arad, which is in 48 Israel, and was a refugee in 48. His family were, they you know, became refugees, and they went to live on these lands where there had in often in the summertime been their grazing lands. And now has been their permanent residence since, you know, the early 50s, at the very least. So it is both. It is both. Yossi, will you go ahead?
Yeah, thank you so much for your presentation, because I think the information you give is so important for people to know. What I just wondering, as part of your work, do you give some presentation in the US or mostly in Israel? Who is your audience that you are talking to? Or if you talk to audience, what I call more mainstream, that never heard about this issue, never knew nothing about the occupations, the treatment, the land, the settlements, the abuse. What can you tell us about this?
Sure. So I think for me, there are multiple audiences. The primary one, because I work on the American side of the New Israel Fund, which is an organization that has staff both in the US and in Israel, my audience is in the US. But the New Israel Fund broadly has an audience also in Israel. And we speak, you know, unabashedly as progressives about these issues to people who are mostly donors to the New Israel Fund, who are also progressive. Now, sometimes what we do is donor education. We teach people about things that they would not have known otherwise. And we try and get issues that happen in Israel that are, you know, rights-based, justice-based issues to cross the ocean and talk about them in the US. But for the most part, I would say these are people who think the occupation is a bad thing and who would like to work towards ending it and may not know the details of how this works, right? So I'm speaking to an audience that is sort of broadly progressive, but not necessarily highly informed. But for the most part, yeah, the new Israel Fund is talking to those people. We also expand our audiences in different ways, right? Like this podcast that we're developing, the idea is to expand the audience to people who may never have heard of the New Israel Fund, who may never have heard of AREA-C, and to give them some of the most basic parts of this presentation in a narrative form that is interesting and engaging. So we do it all. We're definitely out there trying to talk to a lot of different kinds of people. And in Israel, again, positioning is different. The way that we work is just slightly different because it's to a different audience. But we, you know, the last thing I'll say about that is that we also have a bunch of grantees and they speak in their own voices. And what we do at the New Israel Fund is to amplify those voices. So whoever is interested in hearing from those organizations is also probably going to be hearing from us. And the other way around. Uri, and I think, is there one more? And maybe then I'll go into my last little bit of presentation. Uri, you're muted.
Hey, now. Can you hear me? Yeah,
yes.
Okay. So it's not a question, it's actually a comment. First of all, I salute you for your courage and I salute you for what you've been doing. And as an Israeli who's been living here for a long time, I'm ashamed of my government and I'm ashamed that all these fanciful maneuvers that the Israeli government is doing in the name of, I don't know what. The principle of basically has been established 120 years ago. Everything is ours and anybody else is on our land, we have to kick them off. And it reminds me basically the travails of the Jews 100 years ago, 200 years ago in other places in Europe, where the authority were doing the same games to them. So I'm deeply ashamed as an Israeli, as a citizen, as an American citizen, and all this foilish stick, all these games that they play, supposedly under the name of the Israeli Supreme Court and the High Court of Justice, are games. And everybody knows it. And when they talk about all kinds of nice words like justice and like morality and like the world conscious and all that thing, for me, they're hollow words. Because deep down, when you look at the resolution that you're looking, it puts the state of Israel and all its contentions to shame. Because if people really knew to the details that you're talking about it, I think that Israel would have been actually kicked out of the nations in the world a whole lot easier. And the only savior is really the umbrella that the United States gives them as their kind of like client state. But other than that, this is really the, on the fundamental level of behavior, this is really disgraceful. So kudos to you for your effort. Thank you.
Sorry. I'm gonna go ahead and share one more screen. And I'm gonna show you a website. It's called Save Sefer Yata. And it's basically a kind of place where you can find resources and get engaged in an activist kind of way. It was created by a bunch of activists who, many of whom I'm friends with, but some of whom I really don't know, which is fantastic. And it has a bunch of photo essays, which I also encourage you to read. Some of these people are really quite amazing. So, you know, this is Zuhur Muhammad Awad. She lives in Touba, the village that I mentioned. And, you know, this is just the story of her life, living in caves and creating cheese and having 15 children, many of whom she gave birth to without any kind of medical assistance because getting to Yatta was too complicated. And she also, I believe it's her, who once took a donkey in order to give birth on those crazy roads in order to get to Yatta. So this is just a brief snapshot of like something that people are doing to get involved and be aware of this struggle. What I'm gonna do here is I'm gonna just like reiterate a bit of what I see as the great challenge of fighting the occupation today. And then I'm gonna give you a number of different organizations that are doing different kinds of work in this area. And then I'm gonna have to leave pretty much at the hour. So I think it's important for us to sort of realize what it is that we're up against. I think that this group doesn't need convincing. It sounds like that there's a real system in place that's trying to reduce the population of Palestinians who live in Area C, and specifically those who live in the vicinity of settlements, based on historical evidence, public statements, and certainly what's happening on the ground. I was telling Jeff earlier that actually there's archival footage that wound up being important in the case that ACRI brought. Minutes from a meeting where when Ariel Sharon was the agriculture minister in the 80s, he said explicitly that the point of these firing zones was to reduce the population of Palestinians who lived in the area. It's not subtext, it's straight up text. So, you know, the army has many ways of doing this. One of them is firing zones, but there are also things like archaeological parks, you know, settlement outposts in general. So it's really important to sort of just recognize that there's a large system at play here. And for those of us who seek, you know, Palestinian independence, peace, equality, and because we don't see any kind of bravery from the international community right now, the key is really to stand up and resist alongside Palestinians. And like I said, you know, the language that I like to use is not the language of coexistence, it's the language of co-resistance. And the South Hebron Hills has been a very, like I said, a unique space where they have been extremely welcoming of international and Jewish and Israeli activists for a very long time. And it's a very strong and welcoming community. And so it's a really good place to get involved in activism if that's something that you're interested in. So of course, the New Israel Fund, alongside a group of progressive Israel organizations in a network called the Progressive Israel Network, sent recently a letter to the Biden administration just before he went on his trip to Israel a few weeks ago, calling on him to prevent specifically this, the forced displacement of the people of Musafir Yatta. That group has also done a number of webinar sessions and is very involved in sort of educating the American Jewish public on these issues. I'm happy to send you a link to sort of sign up for, let's say, you know, NIF emails. We're talking about this with some consistency. Like I said, ACRI, the Association for Civil Rights in Israel, another organization that works in Israel, basically the Israeli ACLU, has been taking the state to court for the last 22 years. And actually, even though they lost this case and they recognized that it was a loss, we're not kidding ourselves here, is still working on the case. They've requested an expanded hearing, expanded panel of judges to hear the case one more time. And that there is an expectation that that will happen actually very soon in early August. And of course, they've been, you know, filing injunctions that the military stopped training. So they're one to follow. There's an organization that is dear to my heart called the Center for Jewish Nonviolence, not an NIF grantee, but it brings delegations of American Jews to this region to be in solidarity with Palestinians on the ground. They work in a few locations around the West Bank, but one of them is Musafir Yatta. And it's an incredible organization, and I recommend you looking into it. I think this group would actually specifically like it a lot. There's a group that many of you I'm sure have heard of that I mentioned earlier in this talk called Breaking the Silence, which is a group of former IDF soldiers who speak about the things that they were asked to do and what they wound up doing as members of, you know, the Israeli military in as part of the occupation. And they work to educate and activate Israeli society and talk to key decision makers to try and shift the situation. There you have a recent report that's out today, which you can look up. It was published in The Guardian. And I believe it's about the bureaucracy of the occupation and how that the bureaucratic kind of like unseen matrix creates a system of control that is layered on to all the things we've been talking about. I'll say three more organizations briefly. One is Ta'ayush, which is a very seasoned group of mostly retirees who go out into the field at least once a week and go, you know, walk alongside shepherds and their flocks in order to be there and document and stand in front of, you know, the violence that is that might otherwise be perpetrated on these Palestinian shepherds. They do incredible work. Machsom Watch, which is also an NIF grantee, which does more work in Area C broadly. Much of their work is in the Jordan Valley, which is a very difficult and also very hot, like Musafir Yatta area, place to live. They do small acts of kindness. They also, they take people to their medical visits. They help people get from place to place. They basically just help people live lives that are slightly easier than they would otherwise be. And I will also send right now, actually, a video that you can watch to sort of get you a sense of what we're talking about that NIF produced called On the Ground with a D, which was a series. And this one is specifically about the Jordan Valley, and it's hosted by a very serious member of Machsom Watch, which translates to Checkpoint Watch. And then of course there's B'Tselem, which you all I'm sure are familiar, which is the human rights organization, which as I think David mentioned, has sort of signed off on going to the Israeli courts. Whereas an organization like ACRI has not, right? This is what I was talking about. There is a difference of opinion on whether or not we can get anywhere when it's worth it to go to the Israeli High Court among human rights activists. And yes, B'Tselem is the one that really, like, if you're looking for the details, they're the ones with the details. And they have, you know, reports about the firing zones. They have reports about, you know, the challenges and the lacks that exist in Area C for Palestinian residents, and just a real, like, trove of detail, as I said. I got through all of what I wanted to tell you today with 1 minute to spare. So I'll thank you for coming, and thank you for having me. And I hope you enjoyed.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Eliseva.
Excellent, Eliseva.
Thank you.
Thank you. And all of the links that Shev put on the chat will be on the email that has the links to the recording.
Yeah.
Have a good night, everyone.
Thank you.
Congratulations on your baby.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, baby. Again. Thank you. Okay, good job.
Wow.
Okay, guys, thank you very much. Remember, in 2 weeks, also at 5 o'clock, and I think that one will go 2 hours, will be Mitchell Plitnick, who I think we all know.
What is doing now?
Excuse me?
What is Mitchell Plitnick?
Plitnick.
Plitnick, what is doing now?
I think he sort of has his own organization and tries to live, you know, get people to pay him to talk.
Okay.
I don't know, but he used to be in JVP. That's where I first met him about 20 years ago in Berkeley at when JVP could have a convention that would fit in your house.
Mm-hmm. Where does this woman live that just talked? Where does she live?
Sorry, who said?
She lived Goldberg.
She lives in New York. I could tell by the windows. You looked out her windows, you knew she.
Yeah, she lives in New York.
Okay.
She said that too.
Okay, guys.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff. Bye.
Well, that's very good. Bye, everybody.
I haven't forgotten your request. I'm working on it.
My theological.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you. Bye.